I bring you greetings from the Virginia Theological Seminary and from other communities that are looking at their history, indeed, at this time. I think my Sunday parish in Middlesex County, Virginia, just celebrated 350-something, one of those big anniversaries, and we had Michael Curry come for that celebration, which was absolutely lovely. What I would like to do today is really to talk about three things, using St. James in particular as a model of a more general phenomenon, particularly in the colony of Pennsylvania. I'd like to look at the state of the Church of England and its congregations in about 1760, at the mass difficulties faced by the Church of England during the American Revolution, and about the very important leadership that Pennsylvania Episcopalians provided in reorganizing the church in this, not only in this state, but in the nation as a whole. In about 1760 or 1761, the Reverend Thomas Barton, who was the third clergy person of the Church of England connected with St. James, and who enjoyed more success than his two immediate predecessors in a variety of ways, wrote a letter to the Church of England explaining how his work was going in Lancaster and also in nearby counties of Chester and Berks, where he had attempted to establish and to care for other congregations. He said this to the secretary of the Society of the Propagation of the Gospel. He said, "His churches made as decent as appearance as any churches in the province, those of Philadelphia excepted." And he said, "His churches were crowded every summer, every Sunday during the summer, with people of almost every denomination who come, many of them 30 or 40 miles, to attend worship. The Church of England," he said, "had gained a respectable footing in this part of Pennsylvania." But he was writing to the agency that provided his salary and was a source of funds. So he did not hesitate as well to point out how things could be better than they were. His chief complaint was that the church was not established in Pennsylvania in the way that it was in Maryland, Virginia, the Carolinas, and Georgia, and the way it had been partially established in the early counties of the colony of New York. Now, he made clear that one of the reasons for establishment was political. "My people have continued to give proofs of that submission and obedience to civil authority," he said, "which is the glory of the Church of England to inculcate." Now, he didn't refer to his own example, but he could have easily referred to his experience prior to coming to Lancaster during the French and Indian War. He not only encouraged his people in the midst of war, but when he heard that French or Indian were approaching, he would round up his parishioners and march at their head to go out in defense of the colony. And when that didn't seem to occupy him enough, he volunteered himself as a chaplain and went with a colonial officer and encouraged people of all denominations. The people of York later would write praising his effort to the Society of the Propagation of Gospel in foreign parts, saying, "He has distinguished himself at this time of public danger with so much zeal and warmth on behalf of liberty and Protestantism." They noticed the denominational connection of the French. "Not only to his own people, but to all Protestant dissenters here, he has endeared himself. He has persevered by word and example." and he has defended us against the savage and murderous enemy. Now, the people of York probably were making an unfavorable comment about Native Americans, which Mr. Barton himself would not have agreed. He was a supporter in his letters to the Church of England about ministry to Native Americans, and at one point took a mixed race young man in his own household to provide instruction. But in any case, he made the point that part of the value of the church, he said, would be to provide greater support and loyalty to the Church of England in the colonies, in the churches in which he served. But he complained about the lack of establishment. He was right that there were key advantages that his parish did not enjoy. In Maryland and Virginia, in the Carolinas and Georgia, the government taxed the people for the benefit of the church, gave the church the responsibility for public welfare, not only dedicated pieces of land for church buildings, which I understand happened in Pennsylvania for a variety of churches, but gave large tracts of land to the support of the Church of England. New York was a little different. There was an early attempt in New York to create an establishment of religion, but the framers of that early legislation never said what church it was they were establishing. And so there was a fight between Reformed Christians and Presbyterians and members of the Church of England about who exactly was to be supported, but there's no question who the major beneficiary in Manhattan was of that legislation. A little Episcopal congregation known as Trinity Church, which was established by the Church of England and then given by the Queen 250 acres of prime real estate on which Wall Street now sits. In 2013, the New York Times estimated that the remaining of that patrimony was worth over $2 billion, making it one of the wealthiest churches in the nation today. And Mr. Barton would not have minded had St. James received the same kind of care and support. In addition, in colonies to the south, there were other advantages to the Church of England. One of them in Maryland was organizational. In Maryland, there were no fights over who was to be the clergyman in a parish, because the governor appointed them all. And the legislature was so generous that they never had any trouble finding clergy to serve in Maryland. Their salaries were roughly twice as high as Anglicans, as members of the Church of England, anywhere else in the colonies. No such advantage could be claimed by the church in Pennsylvania. Paradoxically, there was another advantage enjoyed by the churches of New England where the Congregational Church was established. There was one big target about which people could complain, and the Church of England and its clergy situated itself very much as Avis Car Rental did before 2012. Some people may remember the We Try Harder campaign, in which Avis claimed, here's the big company, we do a better job. And Church of England clergy in New England said, we have a more soundly educated clergy, we have a more coherent theological doctrine, we have better pastoral care, we have ideas more in keeping with modern science, and our preaching is better, and people would be wise to join our church. They were amazingly successful. In fact, there's one story from New England. In the 1720s, the entire faculty of Yale College, which was made up of congregational clergy, converted to the Church of England. And from that period onward,
there was a steady trickle for the next 100 years of people who came to Yale to be congregational clergy and left Yale seeking ordination in the Church of England. There's a story often told around the time that Jonathan Edwards, the great congregational preacher, graduated from Yale, and that is that at least one parish, congregational parish in Connecticut, said, "We will take a new Yale graduate, but only if he posts a bond that he will not convert to the Church of England once he comes." But the clergy and the people of the Church of England in Pennsylvania didn't have a single large target against which they could complain. Indeed, Mr. Barton, writing to the Church of England, had a baffling and long list of his colleagues that he found. He didn't say, "They're just Quakers here." His list was this: "I am surrounded by German Lutherans, Calvinists, Mennonists, Moravians, Newborn Dunkers, Presbyterians, Seceders, Covenanters, Papists, Independents, Jews, Brownist, and Mountain Men." Now, most of those will be relatively clear to you. Some of them are ethnic titles. German Lutherans. The Seceders and Covenanters were descriptive of separate groups within the Presbyterian Church of Scotland or outside of the Presbyterian Church of Scotland. The Brownist were the Pilgrims, the Separatists who followed the example of Thomas Brown. Other descriptions were liturgical. The Dunkers were the Church of the Brethren, who dunked, who baptized by immersion adults as their normative liturgical practice. And other descriptions are, and my eyes are failing me here, but there are other descriptions are of significant leaders. The Mennonist or Mennonites, followers of Menno Simons, as in the example of name. I puzzled for a long time over the Mountain Men in a description until I finally discovered, and maybe I ought to know this because I have a Welsh surname and am a descendant of those people who emigrated to Pennsylvania about the time that Mr. Barton was writing. It became common in the early 19th, late 18th century, to refer to those people touched by Welsh revival, by the preaching of people like Evan Evans and others, to say of them, they are so full of the Holy Spirit that they leap up on top of mountains. So it may be that the Mountain Men is a slur, a characterization of, there are a bunch of those Welsh evangelicals here as well. But there was no single target at which he could aim his preaching and direction. Again, he felt he was at a disadvantage compared to churches in the north and compared to churches further south than Pennsylvania. He and the Anglicans, the members of the Church of England in Delaware and New Jersey, shared that same state, if you will. There was one further matter with which he was concerned, though he thought that the people of Pennsylvania of the Church of England had it in hand, and that is he was worried about the Great Awakening. Now, the Great Awakening is a round of revivals that starts with a preaching of George Whitefield about 1740 and continues with little abate until the American Revolution and then heats up in the following century in what is often called the Second Great Awakening. The short explanation of the Great Awakening is this: it is the combination of the doctrine of justification by faith alone of the Reformation with a psychology descriptive of how that experience of justification was to feel. And so people often preached with long stories about their personal experience, wrote and sang hymns that were descriptive. "I once was lost and now am found, was blind and now I see. 'Twas God who taught my heart to fear, and God my fear relieved." So that there's a kind of description, and It, though often portrayed, and I often do this as well, as a wonderful, positive religious revival in the colonies, it also was deeply divided. And it divided Congregationalists and Presbyterians into competing groups. It led many to leave those churches and form Baptist churches of two different groups who disagreed with each other. And it would ultimately lead in 1784 to the departure of many from the Church of England to become part of the Methodist churches in the United States. Now, he wrote that nobody in the colonies, in the Church of England, in the province of Pennsylvania, was attracted, was moved. We have stood firm, and he quoted the lines in Timothy about silly women being attracted to strange preachers. That did not happen, he said. Philadelphia accepted. And he was right, though, about Philadelphia. I'm not sure that he was entirely right about everything else. About 1760, Christ Church Philadelphia had hired a man named William McClenaghan, who became very interested in the Methodist and Whitfieldian movement and led a large number of people out of Christ Church to form St. Paul's, which was the largest New Light Anglican congregation in the colonies. He was then replaced after a while by a man named Jacob Duché, who came from England. And Duché immediately was identified by others as a sound Whitfieldian. He went on to be the rector of Christ Church. And he introduced in the parish Whitfieldian groups. That is, small groups that met during the week for Bible study and groups that were vital in trying to promote a personal faith and a psychology of belief. Even St. James Church was not untouched. The first rector of the parish complained that he couldn't get enough money for the building because the vestry was filled with too many new lights who just liked to spend money. And so he felt that there was some support for the awakening in the parish. Charles Inglis, who entered the ministry from the parish, was at least partially identified as a Whitfieldian when Trinity Church New York wrote to Christ Church and said, "Send us a Whitfieldian." Jacob Duché recommended Charles Inglis, who went on to be the rector of Trinity Church New York for a time, and then the first colonial bishop of the English in Canada. So there was some interest, and indeed, by 1760, the clergy in Pennsylvania had begun to gather together, Mr. Barton among them. They met in Philadelphia, and the topic of conversation is, what do we do about the new lights who are even among our own number? What response can we take? They continued to meet at least until 1766. 5 years later, New York picked up the same concern and began to have a series of, I think, three annual conventions in New York. The Pennsylvanians invited people from Delaware and New Jersey who attended. It's the first cross-colonial gathering in the colonies. Those in New York invited others who would come, and some did come from other colonies. It's notable because of the secretary of that body was a man named Samuel Seabury, who would later have an important ministry in Connecticut. They worried that somehow they needed to organize themselves, and interestingly, the first proposal for organizing a national church came out of the 1766 meeting in Philadelphia, of the Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware clergy, about how one might organize a parish, might organize a national church. Now, when the American Revolution began, The Church of England found itself in a terrible condition and was more negatively impacted than any other American denomination. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. In some states, it was required in the Church of England to post on the wall of the church only one decoration outside of texts like the Ten Commandments and the Lord's Prayer, and that was the Royal Coat of Arms, which was not popular among patriots. All of the clergy of the Church of England had been required on ordination to agree to use the Book of Common Prayer. And every public service of the Book of Common Prayer for use on Sunday included prayers for the royal family and for the king, that the king might overcome all his enemies. And clergy understood that they had no choice but to say those prayers, which was not thought to be popular. In addition, there were great financial problems. All of the states that established religion of the Church of England suspended salaries by 1776. And as far as I can tell, they've never been restored. In the case of Virginia, the government began to take back church lands, church buildings, and communion silver, saying, "We established it and we want it back." In Maryland, they were in confusion, and they would go for a long period of time in which they seemed to appoint a new rector every year because they lost the governor as the one who provided some succession in the appointment of clergy. The three colleges that had strong Anglican presence, King's College, Columbia in New York, the College of Philadelphia, and the College of William and Mary, all of which have been training clergy for the Church of England, were reorganized in such a way that they could no longer serve that function. The name of the Church of England, was not an advantage during the American Civil War. It's rather like in the Cold War when the Russian Orthodox Church in America changed its name to the Orthodox Church in America, so as not to emphasize its roots. It was not popular to be called the Church of England. And in addition, the Archbishop of Canterbury was a wonderful gentleman named Frederick Cornwallis, and his nephew Charles was a leading British general. Mr. Barton wrote back already in 1776 and said, "The people of this town will not allow me to have public worship unless I leave out the prayers for the king, which I in conscience cannot do." In some places, when clergy persisted, not only the clergymen, but male members of the congregation were arrested because of their use of prayers for the king. There's at least one clergyman who solved that by having a congregation entirely composed of women, because apparently the patriots did not arrest women for being present where there were prayers being said for the king. In addition, there were no further ordinations because clergy had to be ordained in England by a bishop. There were no resident bishops. The Church of England, which arguably was second largest in the American colonies in 1776, by 1800 would be the sixth largest church. Now, laypersons did not in general face as strong opposition if they sided with the patriots, and they certainly had never taken an oath always to read the Collects to the King. So if you look at St. James, you will find there are people like members of the Ross family who were strong supporters. Mr. Ross signed the Declaration of Independence, which would have been hard for Mr. Barton to do. You have people related to the parish, the brother-in-law of the rector, David Rittenhouse, who was supportive of the revolution. I believe there was a parishioner of St. James who was a gunsmith and provided weapons for the American soldiers and was praised by the Continental Congress for so doing. But clergy were in trouble, and the Church of England fell in numbers from second to sixth. I was invited about half a dozen years ago to write an article for an English dictionary, the mandatory religious chapter on the Church of England in America or the Episcopal Church. And I wrote it, and the editor made one mistake because he simply could not believe what I wrote. I said after, by 1800, Episcopalians had fallen to the point that they were only 0.5% of the American population. And that's a pretty good estimate. The editor changed that to 50%. He couldn't believe that the Church of England had shrunk so low, but indeed it had. By the 1780s, however, matters had begun to change, and interestingly, all the disadvantages of the Church of England in Pennsylvania turned into chief advantages in the reorganization of the church. There were many clergy left. About a quarter of the clergy or more left. The Society for the Propagation of the Gospel said they supported 77 clergy, almost all of whom were not able to lead worship after the Revolution. Mr. Barton found himself under house arrest or in jail for 2 years. He was able to relocate in New York, where he died. 2 years later, the SPG said it was of diseases that he developed while he was captive. But it's interesting, there are two groups of people, or maybe three, who were likely to be less troubled than Mr. Barton about abandoning their oath to pray for the king. They are clergy in Virginia and Maryland, where establishment was very old, and where, for in the case of Virginia, for more than 100 years, the local legislature had interposed itself between the Church of England and the local congregations. So people got orders, but they didn't come from London. The Archbishop of Canterbury or the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel, they came from the legislature. And the legislature said, what you're doing, just stop. Pencil through that, put Continental Congress where it says king, and many people, particularly those who've been in the colonies a long time, were able to follow those instructions. Second group, which is overlapping, are those people who were born in the American colonies themselves. Those who had been raised in England, like Mr. Barton, or in the UK, like Mr. Barton, found it far more difficult to abandon oaths they made. And finally, it helped to be a Scot. Because the Scots had a long history of not paying attention to what the English had to say. If you look at Pennsylvania, there was a small number of clergy who survived the Revolution. Many had left. Jacob Duché, the rector of Christ Church, initially announced he favored the Revolution, became a chaplain to the Continental Congress. As soon as the British took Philadelphia, he changed his mind and he retreated with the British and went back to England. Mr. Inglis followed the British troops back to England, was ordained a bishop and sent to Nova Scotia. But there were two in particular who were left. William White, who lived his entire life in Philadelphia, was a basic American citizen, became, after Duché, a chaplain to the Continental Congress. And William Smith, who was a Scot and did not mind ignoring what the English had to say. The two of them really spearheaded the attempt to take the Church of England and put it back together in a new form for the American new nation. What Smith did, Smith got arrested at one point for being too much of a supporter of the English. Then he got detained for being too much a supporter of the Revolution. And finally, he fled to Chestertown, Maryland, where he led an effort to take a day school, an academy, and turn it into Washington College. The name left his then sympathies pretty clear. And by 1783, he had done a good job of speaking with parents of some of his students and assembling the first convention of a diocese in the Episcopal Church of the United States. That body selected a new name for the Church of England, which was less offensive. They took the name that the Church of England used in Scotland, the Episcopal Church. Not a difficult reach for a Scot. They elected candidates for priesthood to send to England and sent them. They adopted a constitution. They tried for a while to have government support and then organized without it. And they elected Mr. Smith their candidate to become bishop. He never was consecrated, and the William White, who writes the first history of the Episcopal Church, never quite explains why, but it is widely understood that he was a great imbiber of alcohol and that there may have been some hesitance about having him as the representative and leader of the church in Maryland. And he shared news of what he was doing with people in other places, in particular with William White. And William White, in 1782, writes a little pamphlet, which is The Case of the Episcopal Churches Considered. It was a description of how the Church of England ought to organize itself, and it is very close to both what was happening in Maryland, to what had been proposed in 1766 in the middle colony province of clergy, and not unlike, in the end, the way the Church of England had reorganized itself in Scotland. In fact, it's a pretty good description of the way in which the Presbyterian Church in the United States will be organized in 1789. But he sent out his pamphlet to many colonies. People began to look at it and make plans, and there were two results. The first of them was that in May of 1784, a group of clergy met together in Philadelphia in the first not official, unorganized General Convention, agreed on what they would do, and returned the next year to create the first General Convention of the Episcopal Church. The second response was that the clergy in Pennsylvania nearly had heart attacks because they objected to the idea that laity should have any role in the church. The General Convention, in good Presbyterian fashion, had required that there be an equal number of clergy and laity that meet together in one assembly. Clergy in Pennsylvania, where lay people could not serve on the standing committee until the second half of the 20th century, were not impressed by this proposal. And so they elected two candidates to send to England to be made bishops. The younger one accepted, Samuel Seabury. He went to England, where he bumped into those candidates for the priesthood for Maryland in 1784, the summer of 1784. The Parliament changed the law to remove requirement of obedience to the king and to saying prayers for the royal family, for those who were ordained for the American colonies, for deacons and priests, but not for bishops. And so the first clergy since 1776 were ordained for for the Church of England and the American colonies, for Pennsylvania, for the state of Maryland. And then Samuel Seabury went on to Scotland, where again the Scots were not overly impressed with what the English had to say, and Scottish bishops got together in Aberdeen and ordained him as the first bishop of the Episcopal Church in November of 1784. Two efforts were afloat, and the organization of the church was underway. Now, I think that the people in Pennsylvania were particularly important because of a number of reasons. They had a history of provincial gatherings. They included some native-born people and some people from Scotland who were not paralyzed by the American Revolution. They included a number of people who had graduated from the College of Philadelphia, of which Smith was provost, and from which William White had graduated. That's important because it seems to be the only major institution where John Locke's theory of compact government is being taught, which talks about the sovereignty of the people and the ability of people to gather together to form their own governments. They had a history of dealing with other denominations in a diverse setting. They had some exposure to the Great Awakening and its idea that the creation of small committees and small groups of people is good for the church. If you look at the history of St. James, you'll see that there are societies and organizations set up for everything at various points, starting probably with the creation of a women's group and with the creation of Sunday schools, something that William White brought back from England after his consecration. And they had some history of self-support. The SPG had provided funds to New England clergy and to middle colony clergy, but if I'm reading records right, and this is only a guess, it looks like they poured more money into New England, thinking that they needed more financial support, leaving the people in Pennsylvania with more of a history of raising their own funds, which is an advantage when SPG money stops, as it did with the American Revolution. So they bring a variety of gifts, and I think probably the most masterful act of all was the way in which William White was able to take the Connecticut Church and the Middle Colony Church and coax them together in 1789 to form the Protestant Episcopal Church in the United States of America as we understand it to be today. He had people who actually didn't like each other very much, but he was able to persuade them to cooperate. In those early efforts, at a diocesan convention and general convention, members of St. James were present as they joined in that effort. So we go from an era of growth but perceived disadvantage to really the greatest disaster that any American church has faced in the whole history of this country. People predicted the entire elimination of the Church of England at the time of the Revolution, to a period of time in which the circumstances in Pennsylvania and in New Jersey and Delaware provide the grounds for some real leadership in the formation of a new church.